The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Uttara Tantra teaching on Buddha nature, the Sangha treasure. This mind, being by nature clear light, they have seen the poisons to be essenceless, and therefore truly realize the nature of every being as peace, the ultimate non-existence of self. They perceive that the perfect Buddha pervades them all. They possess the understanding that is free from the veils, thus seeing that beings are utterly pure, and that this purity pervades their limitless number. They are endowed with the vision of primordial wisdom. I bow down to this Sangha. Morning. So this week I spoke a little bit about the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and how these three treasures are really the, in one way, are all of the visible manifestations of the Buddha Dharma. How we relate to the Buddha, enlightened masters, how we receive the teachings, how we practice, how we gather together as a community, as a Sangha. How all of those, what we might call outer expressions of practice, take place. And all of that is particular to the Buddhist path. And at the same time, and really importantly, what the real most important aspect of the three treasures is to realize them as our own nature, as our own body and mind. And in that way, they're not just about the Buddhist path. They're really about all creation, all of humanity. And in that, when we really understand the Buddhist teachings, when we really take refuge in the three treasures, when we realize them, then it prevents us as Buddhists from creating a boundary around Buddhism, because we see that as a delusion. It prevents us from seeing Buddhist practitioners or Buddhist practice or teachings or enlightenment as setting us apart in any way whatsoever from anyone else. The Sangha is the community. It refers to the order. It means that which is struck well together, or struck together well. And we can think of that both in terms of the Sangha of one, you and the many beings that populate your mind and body. We can think of that as how this community, we are struck together well. That is our aspiration. And in that sense, it is not easily broken apart. We speak of it as the virtue of harmony, Sangha. And in the beginning, it began, of course, with the Buddha. There was no Sangha. And then he began teaching. And so he first taught his ascetic comrades, who were still practicing asceticism. And you know, when he came to them, they ignored him, because they thought, oh, there's old Shakyamuni who, like, you know, got lost and went and indulged himself, right, by eating and drinking, and you know, and you can imagine how far he went with that. Not very far. But they saw him as, you know, having abandoned the path. But it said that when he came to them, they saw just his presence cut through that sort of that projection that they had, that those beliefs, and they realized something has happened here. And they made a place for him, and they said, here, sit down, friend. And he said, no, you should not refer to me as friend. And even though that can sound a little egoistic, it was really establishing that they now have a different relationship, or they have a potential for a different relationship because of what he had done and seen and what he was coming to share with them if they wanted. And so that began the first Sangha. And the ordination, which began right then, began as simple as him saying, come, monk. We put our monks through a whole heap of mess to be ordained. Then it was very simple. And it got a little bit more involved as time went on, as things tend to happen. Beginnings are often very simple, and then they develop. And so the order began to grow as he began to ordain more. And in the traditionally, in the beginning, and Sangha was the ordained community. In the Mahayana, certainly in the West, we consider Sangha all practitioners, anyone who practices. In a sense, anyone who sees themselves as a part of the practicing community. And so he began, and this Sangha began to grow, and there were occasions where he taught teachers who had their own communities. And so, you know, remember, this was a period of time that was very fertile in terms of spiritual practice, and it was a time of great change within India and the sort of the moving more towards urbanization, and old ways were falling away, and there was just a lot of change. And so there were a lot of pilgrims and communities and practitioners wandering and looking for answers. And so the Buddha taught, had encounters with some teachers who then basically became his disciple, and then would often bring, or their that teacher's community would then join the Buddha's community. So there were moments in which the Sangha grew exponentially in a moment because of that. And so over the subsequent years, it developed and grew quite a bit. And as it did, of course, rules began to develop in terms of how to organize and harmonize, how to keep this together. What did it mean to practice as a community? What did it mean to practice this Dharma? What did living it mean, particularly within the monastic community? And originally there was no ownership. It was very clear about what a monastic was allowed to have, which was basically what they could carry. But lay patrons, lay students, began to offer land and parks and places where they could gather, particularly during the rainy season, to practice. So the sort of the structures of Buddhism began to develop pretty quickly. There's a time where Ananda said to the Buddha once, Lord, is it true that what has been said, that good spiritual friends are fully half of the holy life? And the Buddha said, no, Ananda, good spiritual friends are the whole of the holy life. Find refuge in the Sangha. I've seen where teachers have said that the most important of the three treasures is the Dharma, because it is the Dharma which is our teacher that we are following. That at the end of the Buddha's life, the Buddha said, it is the Dharma is the lamp that you are following, that you have received. In this teaching, it actually says, the Uttara Tantra, it actually says, the Dharma will be abandoned and is of an unsteady nature, abandoned like the Buddha spoke about the raft that carries you across the river of delusion to enlightenment. And once you've crossed, you don't need to carry the raft anymore. So the Dharma will be abandoned and is of an unsteady nature. It's impermanent. It is not the ultimate quality. And the Sangha is still with fear. You know, the Sangha is still a gathering of people who bring with us all of our karma. And so the Sangha is still with fear. Thus, the two aspects of Dharma and the assembly of noble ones do not represent the supreme refuge, which is constant and stable. In a true sense, only the Buddha is being's true refuge, since the great sage embodies the Dharmakaya, and the assembly is to reach that realization of the Dharmakaya. So it's an interesting teaching. And none of these are really in conflict with each other. They're just different perspectives. In a sutra called The Recollection of the Noble Three Jewels, it says, as for the Sangha of the great Mahayana, they enter completely, they enter insightfully, they enter straightforwardly, they enter harmoniously. To enter completely means we enter, we practice entering, and we, through our practice, we strive to evermore enter completely. That is, without reservation, with trust, with faith, not holding back. You know, when a student comes in and does, for the first time, to receive the teachings after sitting in Tongariro and does 9 bows and asks for the teaching, and they're not told how to ask, they just say, you need to ask to receive the teachings. And the teacher needs to hear that you are asking. It needs to be made explicit that that permission, that request is being made. And then it really needs to be made again and again and again, not always in the same explicit way, but in our minds, in our hearts. So to enter completely, to enter insightfully, which means to be awake, to be trying to see clearly things as they are, to see when we are not seeing clearly, and to have a deep appreciation for the wisdom of the Dharma, to enter straightforwardly, simple, direct, honestly, authentically, and harmoniously. That is to, as the Buddha said, to blend like milk and water, to be in accord, to develop our compassion, our loving kindness, to be noble friends to each other, to join together and understand one another, not in the sense of knowing everything about each other, but because we are here. I mean, the Sesshin is such a vivid example of that, because we're in silence. And yet there's a different level of communication that we become available, that becomes available to us, a different way of knowing each other by virtue of being here and having essentially the same mind, sitting on the same cushion, experiencing the same moments throughout the day. It's very powerful. And so that sense of Sangha as struck together well, of the virtue of harmony, that's a practice, right? It's a living thing. The whole thing is a living thing. We make this up every day. The Buddha said the three worlds is mind. From the beginning of Buddhism, with the Buddha's enlightenment, he began bringing forth, creating the three treasures, creating a path, creating a body of teachings and practices. And we're still doing that. There's a story that comes from an early part of the Pali Canon about where this was not going so well. And I find it very interesting. The Buddha went to an area, Kosambi, where he hadn't really spent a lot of time there. And there was a fairly good-sized sangha, a gathering of monks, nuns there. And he went there to teach and to, as one scholar said, to try and make a connection with the ruler there and to develop a friendship with them. But when he got there, he found out that there was trouble brewing, that one of the monks had committed an offense within the monastic rule. One scholar said that when this monk went into the toilet and used the wash water to wash himself, that when he left, he didn't refresh the water. He just left it there. That was an offense. And so that was found out, and the Sangha, which has a body of rules about how to live together and take care of each other, and so that was an infraction. And so a portion of the Sangha got together and said, okay, you know, that was an offense. Well, the monk didn't see it that way. He said, no, it wasn't really. That wasn't an offense. He says, this was not an offense of mine, not that I can see. And that monk who had done that but did not see it as an offense that warranted the response that came down from the Sangha, you know, his sort of the consequence of that action, it said in the sutra, he was one to whom the tradition had been handed down. He was an expert on the Dharma, on the discipline, that is, the Vinaya, the teachings, the rules of the monks, an expert on the summaries. He was wise, experienced, clever, conscientious, scrupulous, desirous of training. He was a good monk, right? He wasn't just a newcomer, he was some slouch. And then it says, that monk, having approached monks who were his friends and intimates, said, this was no offense. This is not an offense. I am unfallen. I haven't fallen. They had suspended him. That was the consequence. He says, I am unsuspended. I'm not suspended. I was suspended by this formal act, but it wasn't valid. It should be reversible, not fit to stand. Let the venerable ones, you, my friends, be my partisans on account of the rule, on account of the discipline. And so he gathered together, you see where this is going? He gathered together his friends and intimates, right? And so now we have a schism. We have two groups. And so a monk went to the Buddha and greeted him and sat down and said, Lord, the order of monks is divided. The Sangha is divided. And so the Buddha, after finding out what had happened, went to the group of monks where the monk who had transgressed were. And the monk said, this monk sees this offense as no offense. Other monks see this as an offense. If you monks, knowing this monk, who has heard much and who's you know, a good monk, has trained well, is conscientious, if we suspend this monk, if you say we suspend this monk for not seeing this, because the other community has said you're suspended, like you can't be a part of the practice for a while. And the Buddha was basically saying, if you do that, then every time the Sangha gets together, this monk is not going to be there. So the monk Sangha is no longer whole. It has lost a vital part of itself. And that will lead to strife and dispute and contention and brawls. It will be a schism. And so he said, he was actually here talking to the monks who had done the suspension. He said, that monk should not be suspended for not seeing an offense, right, that you, monks, see as an offense. Don't you see that having fallen into offense, that deems amends should not be made? I'm getting a little confused. That monk, keeping the two sides straight, right? He went to the ones that were holding to the rule. He said, if you exclude this monk who doesn't see that he committed offense, you're going to break the Sangha into two. And whenever you gather together to practice, you're not gathering the Sangha together. And that is only going to grow. Don't you think you should release this? And then he went to the monks who were denying that there had been any offense and said, don't you think that you should take responsibility, acknowledge what has happened, and make amends? He was trying to bring them together, but it wasn't working. And they continued to escalate. And it got to the point where the larger community was seeing these monks argue with each other. It said they even came to blows. And the Buddha said, if an order is divided and not behaving according to the rule, there is no order, there is no Sangha. He says, but even if you're divided, in other words, even if there's this conflict, but you can gather together in friendliness, you can sit down next to each other, then the Sangha is still whole, and this can move forward in a better way. But they kept coming to the monk and saying, coming to the Buddha and saying they're still fighting. And so at one point there was a monk who said, Lord, let the Buddha, let the master wait. Be unconcerned. Live intent on abiding in ease here and now. We will hold ourselves accountable for this strife, quarrel, and contention, and dispute. In other words, he was saying, leave us be. We're going to work this out on our own. And the Buddha kept coming back and saying, no, you're not working it out. Right? This is not working it out. And it's going out into the community where people are starting to disrespect and not believe in your integrity, in your path, in these teachings. It's not just about you. And finally, the Buddha said, these foolish men are as though infatuate. It is not easy to persuade them. And he left. And I think what's so interesting about that is that, one, it's part of the record, right? It's not the Buddha in his great wisdom and skillfulness was able to calm these troubled waters. He tried over and over again. In fact, he told this very, very long story to the monks as an example of a king who had had great humility and had gone to great measures to repair a rift within his kingdom as an example to try and inspire them. It didn't work. And so I think it's both interesting that it's there for us to see, and also just to recognize that the Buddha, in all of his wisdom, and like he was the one, right? Like there was no other Buddha. He was the one. He had started the whole thing. He was still alive, right? And we can think, I mean, I imagine that all of his students were like, oh, you know, the Buddha is like completely reverential, always practicing faithfully, always, you know, practicing well. But a Sangha is a gathering of people, individuals who are each practicing in their own body and mind, with their own karma, in their own place along their path, together. And so how does that actually harmonize? How does that strike well together? When there's not a willingness, when the choice is to choose the conflict over peace, when it is to choose the schism, the separation, the division over alleviating suffering, which is a choice we're always able to make, we should at least recognize that that's the choice we're making. When we choose, it's like if, you know, we're angry, somebody's asking for forgiveness, we don't want to give forgiveness, we're still angry, just to acknowledge that within ourselves. You know, I'm not ready to forgive, I don't want to forgive, right? And even if it doesn't feel wholly a choice because we're so angry, to recognize that I am, in a sense, choosing this, maybe just for now, maybe for a long time. And that makes it very, very difficult to practice together, right? So it's one of the things, it's in a sense, it's the thing that holds us together, is our ongoing willingness, our agreement, our commitment to keep taking responsibility for ourselves and to keep stepping in, keep coming in. You know, it's like making a commitment when there's trouble, when there's difficulty, when there's conflict within that commitment, to try and work it out from within that commitment. And so in the sutra, in the Uttara Tantra, it says that the mind of the Sangha is by nature clear and light. It's bright, it's clear, it's spacious, it's wise, it's enlightened. And in that, the Sangha has seen the poisons, our greed, anger, and delusion, our pride and jealousy, to be essenceless. We realize that they don't exist by themselves. This is not something that's happening to me. It's not something you are doing to me. And therefore, we can realize that the nature of every being is peaceful, peace itself, which is the basic nature of the emptiness of self. Because being empty, there is no thing to be in conflict about, nor to defend, nor to oppose. Now, of course, this teaching is presenting the Sangha as fully realized, right? So if we make this a little bit more active, this mind of the Sangha is practicing, developing, realizing, bringing forth this natural, clear light of mind so that we can realize and embody that realization that all of the sources of suffering within us and between us are empty of any intrinsic quality, which means everything is workable. That when we attach to something and hold to our guns, right, I'm not budging, that we should acknowledge that's what we're doing. We're attached to some view, even if we feel like our view is correct, and it may be. The attachment starts to become poisonous, or makes that view, which may be correct, poisonous. Because now there's something to defend and argue about and come to blows over. And so entering completely and insightfully and straightforwardly and entering harmoniously is an ongoing practice. Because Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are by nature peaceful. The nature of all things is peaceful. So when we are not, that's just like a sign, right? There is a conflict. Something is standing in opposition within ourselves. And so to realize this peace, we have to bring forth that peace within ourselves, which means we have to practice everything that is not peaceful. We have to really become adept at practicing all the sources of our conflict. Not to perpetuate them, obviously, but to heal them. We have to practice all that is not peace, and to do that peacefully. To learn how to do that peacefully. Because otherwise, we're just back into samsara and conflict. And so it means bringing forth the Dharma in those moments as our refuge rather than samsara. That we bring forth generosity and compassion rather than greed and anger. Which means when we are angry, fearful, insecure, judging, that long list, that we are trying to practice that from within the Dharma. That's what taking refuge is. I take refuge. That means I am, as Dogen says, unreservedly relying upon the Dharma. The Dharma is my refuge. The Sangha is my refuge. If I mess this up, now what? Now what have I got? I can't mess this up. And when I do, I need to address that. I need to attend that. And that's where the straightforward, honest, direct, open, clear and genuine has to be so. And so what that means is that the Sangha treasure being struck together well, the virtue of harmony, has to, in order to be straightforward and insightful and harmonious and complete, has to be able to hold and allow for a certain amount of disharmony. Right? Because it happens every day. Maybe it happened for you this week. I'm betting it did. Just the odds are, I think, are in my favor. Right? Small things. Dish crew, work period, waiting for a bathroom, something going on in the dorm. And so that disharmony, and of course there are all kinds of unintended things that happen just by living together. And then there are things that we do that are really hurtful. They may still be unintended, but they are hurtful. And sometimes they are intended because we are hurting and we want to hurt somebody else, which is often how that story goes. And so that has to be attended to. And the Buddha knew that right away. Because what happens if it's not attended to? It festers. It festers. It's like a wound that isn't attended to, it gets infected. And what was slight, now we have to take your leg off. And so that sense of, it actually makes things easier when we wait, when we don't tend to it. It makes everything harder because it just gets larger. And so we possess the understanding and the capacity to understand that is free from the veils, that is not, you know, cloudy with our karma, overly cloudy, that is not completely mired in kleshas or greed, anger, delusion, or pride and jealousy, and that is not completely based in our projections. And so enlightened beings directly realize that every person has all of this in each of us already and are essentially at peace. And so we practice calming through mindfulness, through samadhi, all of that activity that creates all that dusting up, right? And we practice ceasing from harm, letting go of all of those thoughts and emotions and attachments and actions that cause harm. But then we also practice generating those good qualities of patience and generosity and magnanimity and tolerance and understanding and empathy and so on. And so we begin each morning with the four measurables. We bow to each other. We take care of this place in which we share. We take care of the Sangha, which extends beyond two-legged beings, which allow us to practice lifting that veil. Because what happens as we are trying to practice that is our karma, right? Our strong negative emotions, our conceptual obsessions prevent us or obstruct us or certainly hinder us from bringing forth that compassion, from opening our hearts, from coming together. And so we practice offering kindness to those who have not been kind. We offer happiness to those who are not happy. We see the good in those who don't see it in themselves. We offer equanimity to those who are afflicted. The text says, the assembly of those who have understanding and thus do not fall back has unsurpassable qualities, since their vision of inner primordial wisdom, which knows things true and broad, is pure. And this notion of falling back, there's a lot of teachings about that, about how we can fall back on the path. In Maizumi Roshi's, what was considered his death poem, Daito Roshi's teacher, Maizumi Roshi, said in part of it, maintain and nourish the one Buddha mind seal. Life after life, rebirth after rebirth, practice diligently. Do not regress. Do not let the wisdom seed of the Buddhas and ancestors be discontinued. Thus, I deeply implore you. And to feel the depth of that, I deeply implore you, do not regress. Do not let this Dharma seed be discontinued. And so a lot of practice is learning how to not fall back. And the Sangha is so important in that, in providing inspiration and motivation and support and responsibility, right? That when we really understand that we're not just here to get what's ours, we're here to give, right? You are needed, actually. Your service is needed. Thank you. Because when that is not clear, then our habits and memories and biases will assert themselves. You know, it's like that reality of implicit bias, that we all have biases because our mind sees differences, but then society tells us what those differences mean on the basis of different rankings of power, skin color, gender, sexual orientation, faith, wealth, location, dialect. The list is long because the kleshas are deep. I spoke a little bit this morning about Tyon, Jack Madden, who was a student for many, many years, who died this week. And I was sharing a little bit about him. And I wanted to speak a little bit about him because he was a very important part of the Sangha, and a Sangha member that most of the Sangha never met and didn't know. He was a founding member of the Lotus Flower Sangha at Greenhaven Prison, which was our first prison Sangha. And so he was there in the very beginning, and was one of a group of about five men who were part of that first Sangha. And he was raised in Long Island and enlisted in the war in Vietnam. And he told me that when he went, he felt very patriotic. He went for the cause. He believed in it. He was a soldier. And he became a ranger, which is in the Army, a very highly trained, he called them assassin squads. That's what he said they were trained to do. And that's what they did. And then he came back. One of the last times, it was a few years ago I saw him, but we were talking about the war, because it was always present for him. And it, needless to say, changed his life. And in fact, he wrote stories, he wrote accounts of things that he had done, missions they had been sent on, to give to the court, to try and offer some background in terms of how he came to commit the crime that he did. Not that the war caused his crime, but it had a part in it. And but that none of that was admitted, none of that would be taken into account. Or the PTSD that he was profoundly living in that led to all kinds of addiction and criminal action and eventually a murder in a drug trafficking thing. But he told me that when he was towards the end of the war, his time, when he was getting close to getting out, that his sense that the war was a noble cause began to fall apart. And he realized he was kind of a pawn in something that wasn't what he thought it was. And he said that was the hardest thing of all. Because he still had to go out on these missions, right? He was still being at risk every day of being killed. And for now, something that he no longer believed in. And then he talked about coming home. And he said he only knew very sort of dimly about all of the protests and all of the anti-war movements that was going on in the country. So when he arrived at JFK and got spit on, it took him by surprise. But he went on to commit a crime, to commit a murder, to end up in jail, and then to find the Dharma. And I spoke this morning about how he was a rough cut piece of wood. He was. And he was beautiful in his roughness. I remember sitting with him at lunch once in Phoenicia, and he was getting older, as we all are, but he was getting older. I said, Jack, what are you going to do? Because he's lived alone. I said, what are you going to do when you get too old to like get around? And he said, I'm just going to go off into the woods like a dog and die. I said, come on. You're not going to do that. And I said, look, I don't want you to die alone. I don't want you to die alone. I said, you're a member of the Sangha. Promise me that you will let me know when and if that time has come. I said, will you do that? And he didn't lie, he wouldn't lie to me. So he just looked at me. And I said, will you do that? And I said, you're telling me no, you're not gonna do that. And he just looked at me. He was a tough nut. But he was a bodhisattva. I remember once doing a zazenkai there, and during a break, one of the students came in who had done jukai, taking the precepts, and he said, look, I just found out that another inmate kind of laid down a threat on him. And he said, I have to go take care of it. I said, what does that mean? And he looked at me. He was a big guy. He looked at me, and he's looking right in my eyes. He took off his roksu, folded it up, and put it on the table. He says, sometimes you have to take this off and do what you got to do, and then put it back on again. I said, no, 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 no. I said, those vows are not in that piece of cloth. And then he just left. And so a few minutes later, Tyon came in and said, where did he go? And I told him the story. He says, and you let him go? And I said, what was I going to do, tie him to the desk? And he said, you shouldn't have let him go. And then he just left. And he went and intervened and cut the thing off so it wouldn't happen. Found another way. It was like that. There was a time where they found the guards were doing a search of all of their gear, which they had to still keep in cabinets to roll out and make up a zendo when it's time to practice in a multi-purpose room. And the guards found a martial arts magazine. And martial arts in prison are like, absolutely not. They are not allowed, not even in a magazine. And so it was a very serious thing that was coming down on the Sangha. And there was a threat that the whole thing was going to come apart. They were just going to shut the whole thing down. And so Tyon took the hit. He said, it was mine. It was my magazine. He had at that point earned, he was in an honors block. He had a really jewel of a job. He was in pretty good, in about as good a situation you can be in that prison. And he lost it all. They bucked him all the way down. They put him like on the worst block, took away his job, gave him some, you know, not desirable job. He lost it all. He knew that was going to happen. He was like that. And he did it all without a word. No expectations of rewards or, you know, thank yous. He just did. Last story I want to tell, because it's I was at a conference, a teacher's conference, and it was down there in his area, and we were talking, and he said, oh, I'll come and see you during a break. I said, okay. So we set up a time and place, and I thought we were just going to sit out in outside and just talk for a little bit. So I went outside to meet him, and he said, come on, come over here. And I went over, and under this beautiful little area where there were some trees, and it was right on the Hudson, he had brought a picnic, this whole banquet. And if you knew Jack, you would just think, really? Because he was a rough-cut piece of wood. And he was just, not just full of surprises, he was full of being a whole person. And he said, I just made a few things. No big deal. So. And he, as I said this morning, he really knew that finding the Dharma saved his life in every way. And he was eternally grateful and eternally practicing. He was a practitioner. And it was always close to him. He came to see Dada Roshi when Dada Roshi was in his deathbed. And he walked in, I remember, with another student who's also from Greenhaven. And he had a big stuffed dog. Dada Roshi's in his deathbed. He's unconscious at this point. I said, what's that? He said, it's for the big dog. Which is what they affectionately call Dada Roshi, the big dog, like dog number one. So we will have a service here for him and bring out some photos so you can see him. But I just wanted to invoke him into this place, which meant so much to him, even though he didn't really practice here actively. He did in his heart. And that's what Sangha is. That there are all kinds of ways that people practice this Dharma and develop themselves. As I said this morning, we can see somebody and have all kinds of ideas and expectations about what the Dharma should look like and not see what we expect to see in a person. And we're just not seeing what there is to see. We're not seeing the miracle of change that has taken place. Right? We don't know where it started. We don't know who this person was. We don't know what they brought to the path. We don't know what they were given in this life. And that's why it's important to check that judging mind, right? Which can be so presumptuous in thinking we do know. Dogen said, the act of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is achieved through mutual affinity and interaction. Mutual affinity. And that affinity is not so much towards our personal stories or towards personality, but it's affinity with the Dharma. And that as we come in and are drawn to that treasure, that jewel, there you are. You are coming. We meet in that place, drawn by that mutual affinity. And then we realize, oh, we must have affinity between ourselves too. And then as we really practice the three treasures, we realize, oh, that affinity actually goes much, much further. It's not limited at all. And so we shouldn't limit it by the appearances, the stories, even the actions. Dogen says, whatever realm you're in, the realm of a deva or human or hell or demon or animal realm, you can have mutual affinity with the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. You can take refuge. You can have that intimate encounter wherever you are, in whatever state of mind, whatever conditions you are, because it's not anywhere else. Think about that. Isn't that wonderful? We have to have faith. We have to actually turn towards and find, make that contact. And in doing that, we will find it. I've always thought that whenever we're struggling in our practice, faltering, wavering, it's because we're getting further away from the three treasures. And the challenge of that is that the further away we get, the dimmer it becomes. We forget, right? That visceral experience, that visceral memory of what those of us who did Sesshin know. Wherever it landed for you, you have experience of the Dharma that you know, you have tasted it. You are still tasting it. But when we stop practicing, that taste, right, begins to grow dimmer and dimmer. And then it's a memory. I remember a taste that was like, and then it gets harder to actually remember that. And so then the incentive to turn around and come back grows dimmer and dimmer. Right? That's how karma works. And so that's why it's always good practice just in all conditions, as Dogen says, to take refuge, to keep ourselves close to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in all of the multivalent ways that those refuges are. In Fusatsu we chant, being one with the Sangha, with all sentient beings, lead the people, let harmony pervade everywhere. And this is not in a, you know, leader of the band kind of way. It's just live one good, true life. If each of us does that, and then we do that together, that shows up. That becomes something that will be seen and felt. So, let us take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And discover over time why that is Buddha Dharma. For me, in the beginning, it was very abstract. It was intellectual. I didn't understand it. I didn't connect with it. It was intellectual. It's not.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.